much less allowed to run, but it also influences people who know nothing about local candidates and will either make their whole ballot Republican in November or Christmas tree it. Tennessee's Senate just passed a bill allowing public school faculty and staff to carry concealed handguns. Instead of just getting rid of the automatic weapons, the Arizona Supreme Court just reinstated an abortion ban from 1864. This social media shit has real-life consequences. We're in a time where at least 50% of adults in the United States get at least some of their news from social media. And doing something that may seem as frivolous as grabbing a photo op with Donald Trump is empowering the people across our states who have the actual factual plans and means to take away our rights and freedoms. So for those of you who feel like you don't actually have a dog in this fight and will do anything for a TV moment, I need you to think twice, three, hell, maybe even four times about what you do in the public eye. Because as unserious as a place social media can be, it's time for all of us to be fucking for real.
And finally, about Candace Owens.
I personally think this Candace Owens pivot is some type of smokescreen, and I'm going to break down why. Now, I could be wrong, but this is just what I think. And far be it for me to speak on her. I don't even like to talk about her, but I feel like I have to for several reasons. Because one, I don't trust anybody who willingly tokenizes themselves. And she's literally made a career out of doing just that. I also don't trust anybody who seeks approval from the morally inept, which she also does. And I don't trust anyone who's willing to throw their community under the bus for the validation of the melanin deficient. And I won't overlook that. Two, I'm starting to see my community do what we tend to do. And it bothers me. We got to stop this now. We have this tendency to disregard or overlook problematic behaviors of certain people when we find a stance or an opinion that we agree with. And I'm starting to see it happen. It always starts off real simple, like, I can't believe I'm actually agreeing with her. And then everybody laughs. And then it becomes, you know what? I've been agreeing with everything she's been saying lately, which is a gross exaggeration. It's been two things. And everything else she said has been wrong. And then it eventually becomes, you know what? I don't think she's all that bad. I think people are hating. And then you open yourself up to being influenced by people that you knew initially not to trust. We don't need to get to that point. Now, most people seem to think that she's doing this because she lost her standing. And it could be, you know, the white adjacency that used to serve her is no longer serving her. So she could be seeking out a sense of community over here, or she's just trying to remain relevant. I don't know. But I think it's more sinister. We have to factor in that this is one of the most pivotal election years in recent history. And people are politically wavering more than they have in recent history because a lot of people are unhappy with the current administration. This is a great time, politically speaking, for the left or right to steal votes from each other. And I think that's what's happening. If they can take a staunch Black Republican and make her seem relatable, that's going to influence Black people to potentially vote Republican. Why wouldn't they want to do that? The only time that they think about us and consider us is during these times. And as you can see, that's what's going on. Trump is selling sneakers that are supposed to appeal to Black people. And then we have him selling Bibles. The best way to appeal to us in America, Black people, it's through religion. We already know this. Religion is a tool and it has been weaponized against us forever, and it still is. And honestly, you guys, if you really think about it, Black people are a lot more conservative than we tend to recognize. If it weren't for racism being a factor, we would have a lot more right-wing Black people than we do. But racism is so heavy in this country that it makes it a little harder to completely side with them. But it's definitely a possibility, and I think that they're trying to bridge that gap. They see that most Black people are liberal, leftists, or Democrats, and they're trying to break that because we're at a time now where everybody's like, I don't like what's going on with this current administration. It's a great time politically to try to steal votes, like I said, and I think that that might be a thing. And unfortunately, we have to factor in that even though we don't like her, she's still a Black person, which means that she still has the ability to tap in the way that we all do. But she's using it against us, and I don't like that. She's using it to play on us, which is also why I don't like platforms like The Shade Room and like The Breakfast Club, because they're giving these people who have been damaging to our community, people who have spewed the most hateful rhetoric about us as a whole, and dangerous rhetoric, a platform to speak. They're giving them a voice, which is basically allowing them to open up and appeal to the masses. The masses being their own community, being us. So you're willing to play on us because you know that having her on your show is going to spark controversy, which is going to get you more views, which gets you more money. But you're doing it at the expense of us, potentially. I don't trust that. I don't trust them. I don't trust her. I don't trust the political climate. So I'm not going to sit here and just think that, oh, this is just because she wants to stay relevant. I think it's something deeper than that, because one thing I know about Republicans is they play the long game. They strategize. Nothing happens instantaneously with them. And that's the difference between them and Democrats. They actually work. They actually go in. They do what they want and they get what they want. And I really think that that's what we're seeing. Now, you guys may have different opinions, and I'm happy to hear them if you want to share them in the comments. But my point is, everybody keep your head on a swivel. Don't fall for silly tactics, y'all. Don't go for things that you can't trust. If you've gone your whole life or the whole time you've known her not trusting her, remain there. People don't just flip overnight. She didn't just come from the things that she said, especially about like George Floyd and us playing the race card, all these white supremacist talking points. You don't come from that to, I just want the best for us. It's time for us to take our standing. Everybody else is trying to divide us overnight. That's a tactic. Don't fall for it.
And that was Ari J in our last segment. We want to thank you for listening. Check us out next week. Peace.
us, who us, yes us, delusion and paranoid, unloving in search of love, like could this be love?
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with the editor of the just-published book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm.
Our interview provides an eye-opening and in-depth analysis of Israel's decades-long occupation of Palestine. We next speak with University of California professor William Robinson on Israel's covert plan to silence the pro-Palestinian movement.
They're operating over here to destroy the lives of many, many Palestinian solidarity activists.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
In the last 6 months of the war by Israel against the Palestinian population of Gaza, a truth has become quite clear. The war is not one of self-defense. And moreover, the October 7 attack by Hamas in southern Israel is being used by the Netanyahu government as a pretext for ethnically cleansing the 2.2 million Palestinians who live there and get them out of the Gaza Strip. Israel, like America, is a settler colonial state. It was built on top of an indigenous population whose removal was necessary to establish the new state of Israel. The Palestinians, who were the majority, never got their own state. 750,000 of them were driven out. Many ended up as refugees in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinians in Gaza are now being systematically slaughtered by Israel and the USA, which is a full partner in the whole operation, supplying weapons, money, and diplomatic cover. The Israeli military is the fourth most powerful military in the world. It has turned the Gaza Strip into a howling wilderness. Most of the native population has been driven to a tiny corner of the south in and around the village of Rafah, where Israel and America are planning an imminent invasion, despite the story spun by the Biden administration that they are working with Israel to try to moderate Israel. This is perception management. Israel is using starvation as a weapon. The Palestinian people are plagued by famine and disease. Israel is allowing food in at an inadequate trickle. The USA ended its funding of the main United Nations support organization, even as it continues, contrary to American law, to ship weapons to Israel, including 2,000-pound bombs and 500-pound bombs and jet fighters to deliver them. Israel and the USA have crippled the United Nations and undermined international law. The International Court of Justice, the highest court in the world, ruled that Israel was plausibly committing a genocide. This ruling has been ignored by Israel and the USA. Today, we speak with OR Books Associate Editor Jamie Stern Wiener about his just-published book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm. His previous publications include Moment of Truth, Tackling Israeli-Palestinians' Toughest Questions, and Anti-Semitism in the Labor Party. Jamie Stern Wiener, a hearty welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Jamie, your just-published book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm, is just terrific. Norman Finkelstein says, indispensable, a tour de force. And I think that this book is going to make a real impact on people. I wanted to ask you, what were your thoughts that went into choosing the title of your just-published book, Deluge, Gaza and Israel, From Crisis to Cataclysm?
Well, thanks so much for those kind words. The book is called Deluge on the one hand in reference to the name that Hamas gave to its operation last October. Listeners will probably know on October 7th last year, military forces of Hamas, the administrative authority in Gaza, they breached the perimeter fence separating Gaza from Israel. They took over Israeli military bases. They captured around 250 Israeli hostages, and they killed hundreds of people. Hamas called the operation Al-Aqsa Deluge, Al-Aqsa referring to the Holy Mosque in East Jerusalem. And so the book's title, in one sense, refers to the instigating event of the current Gaza escalation. Deluge, of course, also evokes the torrent of chaos and destruction that was unleashed that day and which has engulfed the people of Gaza ever since. The figures are actually quite staggering to begin with. I mean, going by Israel's official figures, Hamas-led militants killed more Israelis in one day on October 7th than the number of Israelis killed during the entire five-year Second Intifada period. That includes all those bloody suicide bombings. And in the 6 months since, Israel has turned Gaza into a wasteland. It's no exaggeration, unfortunately. Israeli forces have killed more than 33,000 people. They've partially or totally destroyed over 60%, that's 60% of homes in Gaza. They've systematically targeted hospitals, and they've set world records for the numbers of journalists killed, children killed, aid workers and healthcare workers killed. So it's really unfathomable the deluge of destruction that's been visited on that tiny, occupied, besieged enclave of Gaza. The subtitle of the book, From Crisis to Cataclysm, on the one hand, of course, registers the dramatic worsening of conditions in Gaza since Israel began its genocidal onslaught. But it's also meant to reject from the outset any idea that people might have, and they'd be forgiven for having it given the media coverage, that prior to the Hamas attack on October 7th, everything in Gaza was just fine. The reality is that already before Israel began its offensive and before October 7th, Gaza was enduring what human rights groups had long described as a humanitarian implosion. To put it very briefly, since Hamas's election victory in 2006, Israel subjected the 2 million people of Gaza, that includes 1 million children, to an illegal economic blockade that just destroyed the economy, extinguished the economy. It caused one of the highest unemployment rates in the world, and it turned Gaza into what one senior UN human rights official called a toxic slum. And then on top of that brutal blockade, every few years since 2008, Israel carried out these large-scale massacres to keep the inmates of the Gaza prison camp in line. So one of the important tasks that the book undertakes, which is reflected in that subtitle, is to show that, to put it mildly, the Gaza crisis did not begin on October 7th. Quite the reverse, actually. October 7th is the product, the result, the consequence of a protracted political and humanitarian crisis that Israel and its enablers quite deliberately created.
Jamie, Israel, of course, makes the claim that it's simply fighting a war of self-defense, the fighting for its own existence, if you will. President Biden said at a fundraiser at Radio City Music Hall in New York, and I quote him, "You can't forget," he said, "that Israel is in a position where its very existence is at stake," close quote. What's your reaction to that claim?
Well, I think Biden's comment is both true and false. So it's false because, as Colter Lewis meticulously documents in his chapter in the book, Israel had chance after chance after chance since 1967, when its occupation began, to resolve its conflict with the Palestinians on reasonable terms, which is to say, on terms consistent with international law. The PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which was the leading Palestinian organization for many decades, it was willing to reach a two-state solution with Israel as far back as the mid-1970s. And then even with Hamas, after it was elected in 2006, it repeatedly made diplomatic overtures to the US, to the UN, to the EU, to the whole international community, indicating that it would be willing to engage in dialogue with a view to reaching a negotiated settlement of the conflict. And in his chapter in the book, Colter Lewis documents those overtures exhaustively. Now, regrettably, the US and Israel, instead of pursuing those opportunities for peace, they systematically sabotaged and spurned them. And the reason why Biden's comment is in this respect misleading is that the reason Israel and the U.S. rejected all those offers, it wasn't out of fear of Israel's existence. because, of course, a negotiated settlement of the conflict would have provided for Israel's existence. Instead, the reason Israel rejected all of those opportunities was to secure its illegal occupation of Palestinian land. So in that sense, Biden's claim is just false. However, after October 7th, the claim that Israel is engaged in an existential struggle, I think it does carry more weight. Israel's security doctrine, basically, to boil it down, it relies on the Arab world's fear of it, and now Iran's fear of it as well, what Israel calls its deterrence capacity. Now, that deterrence capacity took a really devastating blow on October 7th, as this tiny, you know, relatively ragtag militia, Hamas, was able, even though it was under siege and Israeli surveillance for 2 decades, it was able to penetrate, apparently with ease, Israel's high-tech perimeter. And so Israeli planners now fear, I think rationally, that unless they are able to inflict a complete military defeat of Hamas and or a sack of Gaza that will ring through the ages, then its enemies in the region, notably Hezbollah in Lebanon, will conclude that they can defeat Israel on the battlefield. And so in that sense, I do think that Israel's existence does look imperiled now in a way that it really didn't between 1948 and October 6, 2023.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with Jim Lafferty, my former law partner and co-host of Law & Disorder Radio. We're speaking with the editor of a new book, Jamie Stern Wiener, has just published Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. It's just a terrific book, 12 chapters. It's the initial big book to come out about Gaza. There'll be others, but I'm not sure anything's going to top this. John Mersheimer said, first-rate analysis, a truly important antidote. And we're very pleased to have Jamie on the show with us. Jamie, I wanted to ask you about the atrocity, no other way to describe the conclusion to the 2018 Great March of Return that the people in Gaza staged marching up to the wall. It was a nonviolent reaction to the oppression of Palestinians in Gaza. Please describe that oppression, and what did Israel do to that great march? And do you think that that was a turning point?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you've asked me about that, because I think those 2018 protests in Gaza and what happened to them are really crucial context to understanding why we got to where we are now. And that's why the book includes a whole chapter on them, which goes through the record in detail. Protests in 2018, they were organized by independent Gazan civil society. And then after they took off, the various factions, including Hamas, facilitated them, provided transportation and so on. In my view, that protest campaign was one of the most inspiring and humbling episodes, really, in the history of mass nonviolent resistance. Every week, you had tens of thousands of people, ordinary Gazans, assembling along that perimeter fence and demonstrating for their rights as refugees and for an end to the illegal, suffocating blockade that Israel was imposing on them. Now, all the human rights organizations that have investigated this and the exhaustive UN inquiry, they agree these marches were overwhelmingly nonviolent. I'm talking about the period March 2018 up to their kind of culmination, their peak in May. Now, in response, Israeli snipers were arrayed along Israel's side of the perimeter fence, and they just systematically, in a kind of methodical, leisurely way,